Hello, and welcome to Tales from the Heart, a podcast from the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Association. And today we are doing a patient story, share your story. In this case, we're doing a sister's story. So to get us started today, I'm going to start with the first sister that I met, and that is Abby. Abby, welcome to Tales from the Heart.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We go back quite a ways, so I can kind of remember a phone call with a very scared young mother who at the time, I believe you were living in Tennessee.
Correct.
And I have not checked the records. And a doctor had recently told you that your heart really looked pretty poorly and a transplant was probably your path. What year was that?
That was 2012.
Okay, I feel really old right now.
Yep, we've known each other for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have. So was that the first time you heard hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? Was that 2012?
Yes, absolutely. I was 34, never had known of any heart issue, never had heard of the condition. My situation actually started just from having some weird symptoms. I was having pounding when I laid down. I was having kind of a racing heartbeat. And what caused me to go to the ER was my left arm went numb and tingling. And that scared me enough to be like, okay, something's wrong. And they immediately admitted me based on my blood work and EKG and told me I had had a heart attack. That was not true. The next morning, they did an angiogram and found that, you know, my arteries were clear and wide open and that I didn't have a heart attack, which I thought was great news. I just had this other thing that was like this little heart condition, I thought, called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
So you called, we went over some notes and I made a statement that for whatever reason is stuck in my head, looked at the records and said, yep, you need a specialist and maybe a transplant, but by the way things are going, I'll probably beat you to transplant. We'll circle back on that in a few minutes.
Yeah.
So you get diagnosed, you are on a treatment pathway, you're living in Tennessee, and you then have to look at your family tree and see, is there HCM anywhere else? And what did you find?
Nothing, like literally nothing. The transplant conversation was actually pretty early on. The doctor, to your point, that I talked to about 2 weeks after this scare, I had an ICD placed for some ventricular tachycardia that I was having while inpatient. And I was still having really bad symptoms a few weeks after being discharged. And when I went back to him is when he just said, and that's when I called you, you know, your heart is like the worst I've ever seen. I studied at Cleveland Clinic. It's covered in scar. You'll probably need a transplant in 10 or 15 years kind of thing. And that's when I found HCMA and reached out to you. Tell me your question again. I was leading up.
What did we find in the family tree?
Oh yeah. So from that, we found the specialist and we found nothing in the family tree as far as prior relatives that had had any issues. What was very interesting is when we went to get some genetic testing done, my sister found some old paperwork that said that she was diagnosed with HCM back like maybe 5 years prior to that or something. But then when they told, this was in the ER, and when they told her to go to a specialist, they said it wasn't actually HCM.
So the ER picked up something that a clinician in an office said no to, but technically Meredith was diagnosed first, Abby was diagnosed second, but we didn't realize Meredith was diagnosed until going back to evaluate some symptoms and saying, wait a minute, what's happening here? So Meredith, welcome to Tales from the Heart.
Thank
you. What was the first time that you remember hearing hypertrophic cardiomyopathy?
I was 19. So it happened, I was 19, 20, something like that. I was having issues actually driving to work. I was like falling asleep and I didn't understand. I was sleeping for 10 hours and I just, then I started having palpitations for the first time in my life and I didn't understand what they were. So I did go, actually, I went to urgent care and then urgent care sent me to the emergency room based on my EKG at the time. So then the emergency room did more testing. I went into observation and they said you know, they didn't echo. I remember that. And it was like that you have mild HCM is what they told me. And I was like, okay, what does this, like, they didn't say anything else. Like it didn't, it, to me, it didn't seem like it was a big deal. So I was just like, okay, it's not a big deal. And then, once my sister had everything happen and she said that word, we both were like, wait, cause that was the first time cardio issues were in the family. And I was like, I think that was something that they might've said back when I was, you know, going through that stuff. And so I looked and it was, it said HCM. And then, we all went to get tested. And then they told me that I had, that I did not have HCM, that I had, unspecified chest pain. So I had unspecified chest pain for many years, and I actually was diagnosed about 10 years later, I think, 30. So yeah, around 2017, actually in 2017, I was diagnosed at Northwestern.
So 2017 is kind of an important year for two of us. Mm-hmm. So that joke that I made the first time we spoke that I'd probably beat you to transplant, I didn't expect it to be in the same month of the same year that we both got there, but I did go first. I did go first by what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. Mm-hmm. So the magic sauce of this particular podcast is, the three people that you're hearing from today have all survived a heart transplant due to hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And statistically, we're quite rare within the HCM community. About 5% of us will move on to transplant. And there are some things we look at in certain families. I have another family who has, wait, 1, 2, 3, 4 siblings with the transplant. And now one of the siblings, their child has been listed for a transplant. So there
I just told Mary about them the other day.
Yeah, they're amazing. Mm-hmm. I gotta get all them up here. That's a little harder to collaborate. We got
they're all over the country.
They're all over the country. We got them down in the south. We got them in California. We got them. I don't know where they all are right now, but we got to find them. Got to bring them back together. We got to do this with them. So sometimes it does run in the family, and while okay, so Abby, my favorite moment of yours transplant story is your announcement that it had happened. I love that.
I loved it.
I loved it. I didn't even know you could sing. Why don't you tell everybody what you did?
So my background is in vocal performance. My degree in college is actually in commercial vocal performance. And I never did it as a career, but I do love to sing. And so I decided to do a Facebook Live after I had been, I waited inpatient in the hospital for my heart. And, you know, I was giving updates about how each day went and just waiting on that call. So when I finally got it, I went live and I sang that it was, I had gotten the call. So, and you put it on the HCM page.
Yeah.
I did.
I started off at last. That was the key one.
At last. It was my call.
It was awesome. And I was so happy. And your call, was it Valentine's Day?
I got a call on Valentine's Day, but I turned down that heart.
And then the next week is when it happened.
The 27th. So it was almost a couple weeks later. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So some years it will be HCM Awareness Day on your day. Because it'll fall the last Wednesday. So, yeah. So I left the hospital on the 14th and then you got your call like 2 weeks later. But we were both February 2017 transplants.
Yeah. So my husband says you were his life-saving grace the night of the transplant. He was up all night chatting with you. So thank you for that.
I was on prednisone at that time. I wasn't sleeping. I was invested in your successful transplant and your husband and we were texting. I think I called him a few times. It might've been like 2 a.m. It was fun. We did have a good old time and he's like, they said this. I'm like, it's okay. That's normal. So like we got through it. That was a wild time for me because I was just about where Meredith is now, maybe a little bit sooner. So yeah, Meredith, you're almost a February transplant.
Almost a day away. No, 2 days away.
You woke up in February, so maybe
Wake up in February. So my transplant happened on January 29th, and then I woke up 5 days later and didn't realize it was 5 days later. But so my journey through transplant has really been in February. And funny enough, I didn't realize this. Abby's first call was on Valentine's Day, and I discharged on Valentine's Day. So
did I.
So did she.
I did not know that. That's fantastic.
Which is also the National Donor Day.
Yep.
And you get like one of the best lines ever. I went home with a new heart on Valentine's Day. That stops everybody in their tracks when I explain that. They're like, that is so cool. I'm like, yeah, but I had to go in on Groundhog's Day.
You don't want that process repeating over and over.
Please don't let it be like the movie. So it wasn't, I was a little bit easier. I was up within 24 hours of going into the OR, I was awake. And Meredith, you had a little bit of a protracted recovery those first few days. Yeah. And you've gone back and you've read some notes and you saw some scary things.
Yeah.
But we do scary things when we transplant. We agree to transplant.
Absolutely.
And it's not for the faint of heart, pun intended, but not necessarily all pun. It's a hard process. It's a psychologically difficult process. It's a physically difficult process. It's not a procedure and it's over. It's a new way of life.
Yeah.
And it's a long recovery. Abby, can you share with me some of your thoughts looking back over the past 7 years on the emotional journey and the physical journey?
Yeah, that's a lot to wrap into a sentence or two. What I've been telling Mary, because I've been thinking about this a lot as she's kind of, recently gone through the same process this year. I feel like there was a before I was diagnosed Abby, and then there was a once I was diagnosed Abby, and those were very, very opposites. I was, before diagnosis, I'm a total extrovert. I'm in sales. I'm an out there type of person. And then after diagnosis, I had to make some decisions. And part of that was I can't do that anymore. I don't feel well. Mm-hmm. So I could either pity myself and go into a deep depression, or I could decide how I can adjust my life to still stay happy. And so some of those things included, like, because I needed to be at home, reading more, doing things on the computer more, just learning about new things. And then post-transplant, it's like you have this decision to make of like, who do I want to be now? Because I don't necessarily want to go back to the original Abby that was way out there. There's good things that were in this, kind of calmed down Abby version. But I want to take the good pieces from both and determine who I'm going to be going forward, because there's a reason I'm here. So, I feel like you have a whole new outlook on life. And it is not easy by any means, physically or emotionally, but Mary and I have talked about this. It's like this huge opportunity to like almost recreate yourself that I think if it weren't for this circumstance, you rarely have the opportunity to do. Absolutely. You had to sit down in your place for however long. And then during this recovery, you have to kind of figure out what do I want? Where am I going with life? And so, for me, that's included things that I would have never done before, such as owning businesses. I'm a total like type A planner, and I always was against that. And my husband's a creative visionary, and I've decided why not try these things. And we have some really successful businesses now that honestly, I don't think I would have given a thought to prior to transplant. So that's kind of a piece of my story, if you will.
And I think that's really insightful to people who just think we're sick, we get better, we go on. You cannot go through the experience of life with a genetic disease. You didn't do anything wrong. You just won the genetic fault lottery in the negative, right? Like you got this thing, you've got to manage it. And then they tell you, oh, by the way, yeah, that's not going to work for you anymore. It's either a new one or game over. And that is this unrealistic moment. Like, no, I am not that sick. But you are. And we all go through this, I'm not that sick part. Other people go to transplant from different points of view. if you get a virus that attacks your heart and all of a sudden you're sick and you were fine, then you're not, then you get a new heart and you go back to being fine again. That's one level of experience. I was diagnosed at 12. You were in your 30s. You were in your teens. We lived a life struggling through and managing with a genetic heart disorder. And then, oh, you get a new one. And there's a part of you that goes, okay, that's really scary and I don't want to do it. And then there's this other part going, what's it like to not be screwed up? What's it like to have a heart that actually does what it's supposed to do without making you wonder, is it going to fail on you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's a big psychological mind game. And Meredith, you're in the thick of it right now.
Oh, yeah.
So you're like in your second month.
Yep.
Your medication levels are through the roof. So you're on a lot of prednisone, mm-hmm. Celsep, tacrolimus, antibiotics,
yep.
antifungals,
yeah.
anti this, pro that. Everything's there.
Yep.
Nothing tastes right. Nope. Food is yuck. It does get better. Mm-hmm. But give the listeners an idea of the 2 month out, Meredith. Where are you?
So it's a little different. So let me back up some. I was in denial, just like you were talking about, of HCM for years. My sister would tell me all the time, that's your HCM, that's your HCM. And I was like, no, because I saw her and I wasn't as sick as her. So, and I didn't want to be diagnosed with something. I wanted to push through and just say, I'm good. I'm perfect.
So your sister and I might have had a conversation or two about that, just saying.
Yeah. Well, I was in denial a lot and she was, yeah, she looked out for me, but it took some time for me to understand. When I went into heart failure is when I took it serious, is literally, and that was just 2 years ago. So now I think even before transplant, I understood, but it was like I wanted to push through. Okay, my heart doesn't, but I want to go and I want to do these things in life because I'm this age and, you know, and I think now, it goes up and down psychologically. Like the recovery process is difficult. And I try to think more positive about it, but it's hard. Like I express it mostly to Abby because she confirms the same stuff. And it's amazing to have my sister around during this time for her to guide me and just listen and love me. Like nobody else is going to understand. So, I struggle with the medicine mentally. I struggle with feeling different mentally. I also feel like in some ways like, oh, the transplant isn't real. Or like it's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. I'm just going to push forward. And so I am constantly looking forward and I've never processed actually what's going on. And I think I'm starting to do that right now in month two. It's actually 2 months today. So, you know, I think that's where I'm at right now. I'm learning more things about what happened during it. I'm learning more about myself right now and how, you know, just like Abby was saying, who do I want to be? Like, who do I want to be around? Who do I want to surround myself around? What is my next step? And so I think that's a struggle mentally too, because you just don't know. And having a transplant, it scares you in the beginning. Like, what's going to happen? Could something happen at, you know, between now and a year from now? Like, there's just those ups and down days mentally that I have this positive attitude and then I have struggling.
And we talked a little bit before we hit the record button and you were talking a little bit about this and my answer there is going to be my answer for the public. This is completely normal. This is part of this process. We've been through a major medical trauma. It was a planned trauma.
It was.
But it's kind of a big deal. They took our hearts out and somewhere somebody else lost their life. And while we talk about the physical and emotional recovery process, there's something that is a little harder to talk about because we each come from our own backgrounds and belief systems, but some other human was unable to have a meaningful recovery from whatever happened to them. Their hearts became available and we took that energy, that person's heart, and we put it in our body and we gave it a new home and we tried to welcome it. And sometimes it, you know, gets homesick, I think. And sometimes I think a lot about my donor family and my donor. And sometimes I can't because it hurts. Mm-hmm. Because my sister was a donor. My sister's not here to go through a transplant journey with me. She should have been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my sister was a donor, and now I'm a recipient, and the balancing of the universe in my body is a little complicated right now. Yeah. And it's never going to get better. I just have to learn how to live with this body, with this heart, even when she tries to go into intermittent heart block on me and require a new pacemaker. Who would have thought that was coming, right? We didn't know what was going to happen with the old heart. If we kept it, we probably, I mean, I probably wouldn't be here right now. Meredith, you'd probably still be hanging on waiting.
Yep.
But not for transplant. Your sister wouldn't have been here to get you through your transplant.
Absolutely.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
yeah, the donor part is really hard for me. I think I want to know. I don't want to know. I block it. I'm grateful. I'm so grateful. There's just this overwhelmingness of gratefulness. And then like 6 weeks after, you're still grateful, but you start to feel the actual emotions of what just happened with your transplant. Like physically, I couldn't go up the stairs, up and down the stairs without holding on to the railing really tightly. And, you know, that's not even just physically, you have to mentally process that your body doesn't work the same. And I want it to work the same right now. Like I just want to go through it. I want to get it over with and all this stuff. And it hits me sometimes. I hit a wall and it's like, no, that's not what you're supposed to do. You need to take your time, go slow. This is a long process. Like somebody just gave you their heart. You don't know who it is in the beginning. You may never know who it is. That's also a challenge too. My sister never found out who her donor was. And so I'm sure that affects her differently than you who found out. Like,
I got this much information though.
Yeah.
I know a name, an age, and that she had a child. Brandy, 32, mother of a daughter.
Okay.
Sister to Mandy. So she has a sister too. So okay. I wrote a letter to my donor family before my transplant. I didn't wait. And I didn't wait because of the fear that if I didn't survive my transplant, I wanted to say thank you,
mm-hmm.
because being on the donor side, we got a letter back from one of three recipients. And I always wondered like what happened and who they were. Mm-hmm. I know the liver did not make it a year. She did not do well. Mm-hmm. And I know the two kidneys, they both lived 8 and 9 years with those kidneys. And then they went to living donors. I know a little bit about the recipients, but I wish that I knew who they were as people,
mm-hmm.
and I wish them nothing but good wishes. And I hope they're still, it's almost 30 years. And the one was 60 something when it happened. So I'm not sure that she's still with us anymore, but the one kidney went to a 20 something year old art student from Jersey City, New Jersey. That's all I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope he's still out there, and I hope he's still creating art, and I hope he's having a great life and his kidneys are doing okay. But my donor family, I just wish I could do something as nice for them as they've done for me, but they broke communication. They don't follow up with picking up letters anymore. And I may never know anything else. Or one day I may get a phone call and they may say, hi, it's Mandy. And I want to talk to you about Brandy. And I will break down and say, thank you for calling. And I'll cry.
Yeah.
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 And I wrote two letters and never heard back. And after the second one, I had kind of made peace with, after a second letter, like I'm leaving it in their court. I don't want to be a pest. I've put myself out there and I'm at peace with not knowing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely something that crosses my mind. And to your point, I hope that maybe one day someone in the family will want to connect.
Yeah.
I hope so. Meredith, you're really early in the process.
Yeah, I haven't written a letter, but I'm going to at 6 months, probably before that. But I do want to reach out and who I am, what my life is like, gratitude, thankfulness, you know, all of those things. And I think since my sister honestly went through that, it's kind of like when I went through the transplant part, I was so happy on transplant day. You couldn't tell me anything about death. I went into that like, I am not dying. Like, I'm so good. I'm so happy. I think the same would be I'd be at peace if they never wrote back, because I saw my sister go through that process of it and seeing her at peace and seeing her go through transplant. It's like, I almost think it's easier for me because I went through it with my sister and saw these things to kind of prepare myself to know some of it, not all of it, but definitely some of it. And you're right. Yeah. I would rather be the patient.
Yeah.
It was very hard.
It's hard to watch our loved ones go through something.
Yeah.
Maybe we teach as we live. I went transparent to the entire community when I was transplanting because I had two choices, complete silence or complete transparency. Mm-hmm. Nothing in between was going to really work with, you know, my world, and you guys know me. So mm-hmm. it's like, it's all or nothing. I went all. And that meant that I can remember telling people like the first time I had sex after my transplant, like, guys, it happened. It's X amount of weeks after. Life can go on. And then afterwards, I'm like, maybe that was an overshare.
I don't remember it, so it must not have been too shocking.
It's funny because I asked Abby that question, and she was like, I don't know. And I thought, shit, you should know. Like, that's a big deal. I'm thinking 4 weeks, 8 weeks. Come on, tell me something average. She's like, I don't know. I'm like, all right, well, when my restrictions are off, it's on.
3 weeks. 3 weeks. Just saying. I'm not going to say it was stellar, but it was 3 weeks. Okay. Oh my God. Well, that went down an avenue I wasn't planning on. And this is why I don't plan, because it just has to be conversations between friends. Absolutely. So, and I hope that some of our listeners just had a good little laugh there. It is a kind of funny part of life that we don't talk about with heart disease is, you know, the sex life of people with heart disease, because they don't think of heart patients as, you know, we don't think of intimacy. It's a really important part of recovery. It's getting back to normalcy and normal intimacy and just normal relationships. So we probably should talk about it a little bit more freely, but we won't go down that rabbit hole too much.
The other side is like your significant other, your partner or whatever, they go through their own trauma in the beginning and they also want to get back to some normalcy. And they put all this effort into me and Abby, and you know, it's a struggle for them as well. So mm-hmm. yeah.
Then there's the more basic logistics stuff. And I still struggle with it with my family. And that's like family parties and food. Mm-hmm. Like you've got
to keep food talked about that too.
Clean. And you can't have everybody breathing on the food because we'll get food poisoning. And I've done it twice. I didn't do it for almost seven years. And I've had food poisoning bad twice in 3 months. One left me in the hospital for 3 days. And I was eating in the same room as the head of the FDA, the same food. So just because the FDA is in the room does not mean the food is safe.
Jeez.
Literally the commissioner, like the big guy, was a table away from me. And I'm like, the salad must be safe. And I took a bite of salad at a public event. Don't do that with a transplant. You never know. E. coli, hemorrhagic colitis, 3 days in a hospital.
Okay.
Don't do it.
Okay. That's very good. Well,
we're having a baby shower for my niece tomorrow, and Tony and I, our company is catering it. So Mary was talking about that, and I'm like, oh, that's easy. It's family. You're going first. When the food gets opened, you're eating. Then you're good. You know, then everybody else can eat afterwards.
It has stopped me from going back for that second helping,
which is probably a good thing.
It is probably a good thing. And you kind of just do it, right? You just, you take from there and you go on. But if in some cases we segregate, like my niece will make dip, an avocado or
guacamole,
artichoke dip. Oh, and she'll make me a separate container and separate out the, you know, the fruits and vegetables so you can do your dipping, but they'll separate them. Mm-hmm. And it's just a little step that becomes normal in our family. You get used to it. You guys are lucky now because you're like going to go to the same events and you can have like your own little food service.
I said, if I'm not there yet, make me a plate so that I have one before everybody eats. So it's cool that it's family and she's there. It's like, I still have, obviously I'm wearing a mask everywhere, but I still have a lot of anxiety about going out in large groups of people or going to a place. So for me, it would be harder if it was a group event and I wasn't able to say, or I could say, hey guys, can I eat first? It'd just be harder. So I would probably just leave early or eat before I go or something like that.
If you're a loudmouth like me at corporate events, I'm like, excuse me, I had a heart transplant. I need to have my plate made first.
Yeah, I don't. I'm just like, I'm not, you don't need to, I don't tell people I had a heart transplant unless they really know me. I'm like, it's to me, I just look completely
different personalities. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just would feel weird being like that in some situations if I was at work or people I knew, but if it was at an event that I didn't know people.
Oh, this is where you make friends with whoever like the catering manager is, and you just kind of walk over very quietly and go, hi, I'm a little weird. I'll eat from the buffet, but can you make me the plate in the back so not everybody breathes on it? And they're like, oh, okay. So you don't have to make a grandiose statement.
Like Abby.
Well, sometimes I do make the grandiose statement, like, nope, me first. And like, sorry, I'm going to be that girl.
Yeah.
But even when I go to corporate events or, you know, you're doing a business meeting and they're like, what are your dietary restrictions? And guys, I've had heart transplant teams come to me and say, oh, here, we brought box lunches and here's cold cuts and sandwiches with lettuce and tomato. I'm like, do you know the rule book that you give us?
Right.
None of this is in the rule book.
Nope.
And then they're like, oh, well, what do you need? I'm like, just get me something hot. Just get me something.
How about getting
hot.
Served that in the hospital post-transplant?
That's weird.
Well, my last hospitalization, you know, I'm a transplant patient in a heart department. So they give me the cardiac menu and they're like, you can't have this. You can't have that. And they're offering me salads and fruit platters and this and that. I'm like, guys,
every day they did that. Yeah.
No, you just told me no. Just give me a hunk of chicken. Just cook a piece of chicken, throw it on a plate. I'm good. Like, yep. I'll make my fun stuff at home. So there's food issues. There's psychological issues. There's the moment that they tell you you're getting the heart, the at last moment that literally nobody can prepare you for the onslaught of emotions. Is there anything that you guys can compare that moment to? I haven't found anything yet that's even close.
No, I got a rush of adrenaline that I hadn't had in years. I mean, I ran up the stairs. Don't even know how I did it. But I did. It was a complete shock. I was actually in the bathroom when the phone rang and I didn't get it. And my nephew's like, your phone's ringing. And then I noticed it was Northwestern. I was like, okay, I don't know what's going on. And so I called it back and I was like, wait, what? Like, I was so shocked that it even was the call. And then my nephew started recording me because he knew that what was happening at that time. And I kept jumping up and down after I hung up the phone. I was so excited that it was the weird part was I struggled the last year a lot and I struggled. I was on the transplant list, listed as a four for 9 months at home. So I struggled that time because 2 weeks prior, I thought I was going to be admitted because I felt awful. And they told me that I could not be admitted at this time. I didn't need a balloon pump. So I was like really frustrated, really sad, a lot of different emotions. And finally, like 5 days before they called me, I was talking to one of the psychologists at my work and I just let it go. I said, you know what? I'm just going to let it go. It's going to be whatever it's going to be. And that next Monday they called me. Perfect timing.
It was. Abby, what was your experience other than the at last elation? Can you put words on the emotions that were going through you at that time?
No, I don't think so. Mary and I were similar in that once we got sick enough, we were wanting transplant. Yes. That was our only hope. So
and
like
she mentioned,
yeah, when we got the call, it wasn't fear. It was elation. It was, oh my gosh, I have this second chance. You know, I can feel better again. So no, but putting words to it is hard. Is really tough. Yeah.
It's fear. It's excitement. There's a little nostalgia. Like this is who I am today. Who am I going to be tomorrow? What is happening?
Saying goodbye to your heart. That was a huge thing for me. I was like,
you weren't going to do it.
You weren't going to listen. I made you because of what Lisa told me to do.
Yep.
I'm like, you got to say thank you. Goodbye.
And yeah, I'm trying to ignore it. And I'm glad I did that.
I think it's an incredible part of healing. And if anybody's listening to this, who's being listed for a transplant, I often remind people if I'm able to talk to them on that last day or as they're getting the call and getting ready, listen to your heart one last time. Get the stethoscope from the nurse. Listen. And whether you say thank you or fuck you, you have to end the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I thanked my heart for getting me as far as she got me. It was yep. all she could do. She gave me everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
But there was nothing left to give.
Yep.
So I said, thanks. It's an amicable divorce. I'm getting custody of you. You're not done working yet. Mm-hmm. And I've bastardized my heart, and she teaches today. So my heart is she. It wasn't me. These were some of the psychological lines that I built to help mm-hmm. me cope. Yeah. And we all do it differently. There's no rule book. It's like grief. You don't do it one way. You do what works for you.
Right.
And Abby and I are 7 years plus down the road. I just had my little scare. She's good. Randy's pump is good. She just has a little electrical break. And we fixed it with a pacemaker. Mm-hmm. And everybody's like, oh my God, you were sick. No, I was not sick. I had intermittent heart block. I'm fine now. And we still have to take care of this heart. Mm-hmm. Maybe better than we ever took care of our HCM hearts, because they were all broken to begin with. We got broken crap.
100%. Yeah.
100%. This one is healthier. This one has the chance of giving us a lot more years with the people we love.
Yeah. And just the attitude of somebody, your donor. Like, I almost feel like a lot of what I do or my decisions are a gratefulness and thankfulness to my donor too. This heart that I have now, I don't want to go back in any way, shape or form of feeling awful. So it's a lot of gratitude.
And the other interesting thing I wanted to point out is Meredith and I are 7 years apart within 30 days in age. And we also now are 7 years apart within 30 days of transplant. So it's just amazing to think how the disease progression was like literally our time was up in this body mm-hmm. at the same time. It's
38 just, years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot that's the same between us. That's really weird. Like things that'll pop up and she'll be like, oh my gosh, we both rejected in the beginning. And yeah, then we both had never rejected after that. So there's just similar. And we have non-obstructive HCM. So there wasn't a way for us to get a myectomy or anything else. It was either you stick with this or you get a transplant. And I did all of the studies that they had prior and it wasn't enough. They sent me to the heart failure team. So
it is a wild journey to get through transplant. It doesn't end. It just keeps evolving. And statistically speaking, HCM patients do pretty much better than almost any other group of patients because the engine is broken. Everything else is still in good shape.
Yeah.
Yep.
Meredith is now rebuilding muscle that she lost while being sedentary and being sick. And that's going to take several months to regain.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And you're going to go to PT. You're going to OT. You're going to get your brain clear again from all these meds and all this illness. And it's going to take you a good 6 months to a year to fully heal.
Yep.
Give yourself the grace of time. And look at your sister and I, and I'm coming to Chicago and I'm hoping that maybe we can all get together for a little drink or something.
Yay.
I will be wearing a mask on the plane. I always do. I've been doing it since way before COVID. And if anybody wants to give me shit about wearing a mask, I will have a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. If you feel that you have the need to tell me your opinion on this, you're going to get schooled. So keep your mouth shut, people.
Amen.
Oh, I have schooled people.
What do people have you think? Scolded family members before? Just curious.
No.
Okay.
No, they got it.
Okay.
They get it. They get it. They get it.
Good.
But strangers have this real like need to comment.
Yeah.
How do you think that works with the Jersey girl over here?
Not well. I would just be like, pull down my shirt and be like, do you see this? Do you see this? This scar is something, which is why I'm wearing a mask. So you don't have anything to say.
Oh, sometimes I'll travel with my heart in a box and I'm like, yeah, I this is my heart. This is why I'm wearing a mask. Like literally, do you want to see it? I will show you. We will do a full dissertation on what's wrong with it.
Speaking of that, I actually had a heart in a box, which is a new concept now. So that was a difference between me and Abby.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how far your heart traveled to get to you?
Yes,
it was in Chicago.
It was in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It went across town in a box.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And actually are you familiar with Gafforian? He's the director of heart failure at Northwestern. That's her physician. And he was telling us that the industry is kind of transitioning to using the box even for brain death hearts, that keeping them perfused and giving them more time and all that stuff is really what they're leading towards, which was interesting to us.
And he said statistically that the heart in a box is either the same or a little bit higher as far as how well people do.
So so for those of you who aren't geeks in the transplant world, and I will leave it with a little educational note today, and maybe we'll come back in a couple months and revisit and see how everybody's doing. But there was changes to the procurement system, and frankly, there's going to be changes again. And I don't think I like where they're going, and we have to write to UNOS and explain this isn't going to work for us. But they started with a mileage guide that wherever the donor was, they would draw a 500 mile circle. And that if you were a one or a two, you'd get the first call. It'd go out to 1,000 miles, a one or a two on the list, then that would be your heart. If there's no ones and twos in that 1,000, then it comes back to the 500 mile. And then they look at the threes and the fours and they build it up that way. But you could get a heart that's 1,500 miles away that has to be transported all that distance.
Yeah. Wow.
And if you put the heart in a box and you keep it perfused, so heart in a box hooks it up to a circulatory system that's mechanical that helps the blood perfuse through the muscle while it's in transport. The old way, and y'all saw them, they came in igloo coolers.
Yeah.
Literally igloo on ice. Yeah. So mine went for 3 hours out of the body and it was on ice and then it gets restarted. Mm-hmm. If you can keep it perfused, they kind of wake up a little bit happier when they're put in their new home. So super cool technology. I think it should become more standardized, but now they're talking about rather than a 1, 2, 3, 4 listing, that you're going to get some points, and where you are in your points on any given day would determine where you stand on the list. But HCM patients fail differently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you wait for us to get really, really sick, we're going to have a harder time recovering and we may not recover because there's no safety net for us. Mm-hmm. Some people know what a left ventricular assist device is. It's a pump that can pump for your heart. Our hearts can't fit them. So mechanical support is not an option. Mm-hmm. Not many of us will do well with balloon pumps. Some of us will. Some of us need certain medications. Others ones don't tolerate it. So when you're coming up with new allocation scores, they have to take into consideration the variation of heart failure, not just the concept of heart failure. And we're going to have to speak up a little bit more loudly as this process is evolving and it goes in for public comment, because what I'm seeing so far does have me concerned. But this is where advocacy and the patient voice comes to the forefront to make sure that we are heard.
Absolutely.
Ladies, it has been lovely talking. I do hope we come back and talk again and continue the story. And we thank you to both of you for taking an effort through Heart Month and getting proclamations in your towns signed for HCM Awareness Day and going off and picking up one from a different town. We've got lots of fun bling here in the office. And it certainly takes a village to bring change.
Does.
And sharing stories as powerful as two sisters who got transplants 7 years apart. Pretty powerful.
Yeah. And Illinois is next on my list. I want to get the state.
We're going to get the state. We'll talk about some strategies there. And on that note, we'll leave you as a cliffhanger and we'll come back with more. I thank you for joining us on Tales from the Heart. Thanks to all of our sponsors. You can get a full list of sponsors at 4HCM.org. And thanks to Joey for doing our editing. And stay tuned for more content from us. You can catch us on YouTube, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, iTunes. I don't know all these things anymore. I'm too old for this stuff. But it's out there in the universe. Go get it. Thanks, everybody.